listeners to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, and I'm here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm a longstanding journalist of food, health, the environment, policy, and the media, and our show is going on for more than 5 years here on Progressive Radio, and I also report on Alternate, EcoWatch, TruStig, and sometimes on the Huffington Post, where I first started blogging. I have been covering all of these different movements, and our show looks every week at all the ways that everything that goes on in our world connects to our own well-being, health, and the health of our communities, the health of our society, and the ecological balance of our habitat, the planet Earth. And each week on the show, we talk to different experts, advocates, authors, thought leaders, scientists, filmmakers, and more, about all of the different facets of what connects, to our personal well-being and health. As many of you longtime listeners know, I come out of a background of reporting on personal health solutions and had some rude wake-up calls, in terms of really looking at the things that, we do in our world that impact our health, that are going on, in our communities, in our society, systemically. So we have to look beyond the individual health solution to the collective health promotion, creation, and the values of our society. And that's what we cover every week on Connect the Dots. This week I'm really excited to have someone with us who really holds both a systemic and an international view. And regular listeners will know how much I'm into systemic views and perspectives. And so here's a wonderful opportunity. Our guest today will be Peter Cohen. He's a writer and anthropologist from the U.S., but currently living in Brazil. He has a Ph.D. in applied anthropology from Columbia University and has done extensive academic research as well as international development work in countries from all over the globe. It's quite a long list that I won't read to you now. And he also founded and worked for a social media-based citizens action group, and we'll talk about that later, too. What's really fascinating to me is that I discovered Peter's work on Facebook, and he wrote a brilliant post, which I thought was one of the best things I'd ever seen. When I posted it, my Facebook network, which is very active, and you're welcome to join that too, listeners, got real excited about it too. And now, thankfully, it's been published. It was published on July 4th, how appropriate, in Elephant Journal, and it's called Forget This Election, We Need Democracy in America. And that got the attention. I'm so happy he was able to join us from London, where he is at the moment. So welcome to Connect the Dots, Peter.
Thank you so much, Allison. It's a pleasure to be here.
You know, the thing that really struck me in reading your article and in, you know, talking with you further about your work is that here in the U.S., we have gotten into a kind of a real pit around the coming election where we have two of the least popular candidates ever running opposite each other. You know, a certain collection of the population is voting for one candidate, not because they really like or even know very well what that candidate might be about in terms of what they will do or their past record, if any. But they're actually voting against the other candidate and what they stand for. And the same is true on the other side. So we're not only, people are not only deeply divided, but they're voting out of fear of the other candidate and hatred of the other candidate. And simultaneously, we've had a candidate in Bernie Sanders who really attracted millions of people, and for all we know, it's entirely possible that he may have won the Democratic primary, and had that been allowed to go forward and occur, and the votes of his supporters along with those of independents would have created a positive new movement for change in the next presidency. Instead, those forces have, you know, that movement, that heart, that upsurge, the gathering of young people, all of that have been subverted by the way things have evolved. So, and Americans now are deeply divided along these lines, and from within our society, with all of the, you know, constant drumbeat of the, you know, corrupted mainstream media, which I talk about a lot on this program, you know, people are really kind of locking down into their opinions and really need a broader view. And so that is what I am very grateful to see that you're providing. And, you know, please share with our listeners now, you know, your view. How do you see, as an American living abroad, how do you see this election unfolding?
Sure. Well, I mean, first of all, I absolutely agree with everything you said, and I won't repeat it. I might be able to build on it in some ways, taken in some different directions. I think living abroad and being exposed to media abroad and to other discourses, other perspectives, over the last, really, almost my, really my entire adult life, this has really helped me to see what was going on in the United States from another angle. I'll give a quick example of that. You know, I started to notice, for example, in the build-up to the Iraq War and in the early when the war started, I was getting very different coverage, news coverage, where I was at the time in Brazil, and from what I was seeing, because I was following the New York Times and the Washington Post, as I always had, what I was seeing from the U.S. To give an example, just one example, you know, right before the invasion, that was, March 18th, 2003, so in the weeks and months before the invasion, the Brazilian nightly news would open. For a long time, it would open with a panorama of the anti-war protests around the world. They'd say, you know, Copenhagen and Johannesburg and, you know, Jakarta and whatever, you know, Tokyo. And it was just incredible. And you know, you would see this, just these demonstrations happening all around the world. And the fact is, that was, especially there was one particular day when, shortly before the attack, that was the largest protest ever. As many as 63 million people around the world participated in these protests. So, you know, but this was something, then I would go to the New York Times and the Washington Post, and it wasn't there. Okay? It was not there. And we found out after, because Chris Hedges was, you know, had to leave the New York Times, and Phil Donahue had to leave MSNBC, and I was producer, I think, was Jeff Cohen, who left as well, and other people, and we could go on and on and on. There was real fallout. Because people, you know, some people refused to toe the line on it. So the media was involved. Let's bracket the media for a second, because we'll probably come back to that. But the media plays a huge role in this. But what I'm trying to say is that, so it was experiences like that, reading U.S. news and watching U.S. news online from abroad, while also being exposed to other news that really started to show me that the U.S. was living in a bubble when it comes to information.
Wow. Yeah. So basically, you know, it's really amazing because even today in the U.S., you can talk with some people who, you know, get all their information from the mainstream sources, and they have for many, many years. They trust them. They have no idea that those sources are censored, that they're focused, that they leave things out. And I think the candidacy of Bernie Sanders, where, you know, really made that obvious, because there was one narrative to Americans, finally, although being of the media for many years, I've certainly been aware of it, but, you know, it made it obvious. Here's a candidate, and he's drawing record crowds. There's tremendous enthusiasm. His message resonates with so many people, and yet it's kind of, he's represented as some kind of a spoiler, if at all. I mean, they kind of ignored him for as long as possible. And so for the people who in effect were recreating the experience that you've just described, which is comparing the main U.S. media to, in your case, international sources, in this case, to social media and alternative press, people really could do the comparison and see the difference. And what's happened within the U.S., is that it's created two different groups with two different narratives, and you know that
exactly.
The difference is that the people who are participating in the alternative narrative see them both, and the people who are participating in the mainstream narrative are in the bubble. And so we've in effect replicated what you have known and seen going back, you know, more than a dozen years with the war in Iraq, which is a more, you know, an international view of what's going on that Americans are completely unaware of. So let's jump ahead and take this opportunity to ask, you know, what is the world seeing and saying about where our country is right now that we might not be aware of?
Okay. Well, actually, before we get into that, I mean, you mentioned mm-hmm. such important things there. I almost want to go back to some of the
sure.
things you just said
sure.
before we get into this. But about global perspectives, you know, one thing is, all right, well, for example, you know, we've evolved, obviously you and I think we have similar histories in this way where I was reading the New York Times as a kid, you know, I grew up with it. It was, you know, it was something that it was just, you know, every Sunday, the Sunday Times and all that. So I read it and I never questioned the New York Times. It was much later as I grew older, I started to notice things and question. But the Iraq War really blew things open for me. And after that, I noticed more and more about the way they use language. And this is what's tough about the liberal press, especially the slightly higher end liberal press like the New York Times. What makes it tougher nut to crack than Fox News, for example, that mm-hmm. they're more sophisticated in the way. So, and I'm going to give an example of that in a second. I wanted to get to Occupy another way, but Occupy is a perfect example. The New York Times was I'll be a little crass about this, but let's say that the editorial line for me, as somebody who participated in Occupy and was also reading it in various media, including the New York Times, what I felt that they were doing, and it's not the only time I've seen this with the New York Times, is they were pretending to be open-minded and even supportive of it, while mm-hmm. actually being quite dismissive of it, underreporting critical things, misreporting, and never really getting the message across. Because, again, the message that they got out was that this was about economic inequality, when actually it's about power. It's mm-hmm. about private entities that acquire such power that they control our society, our political system, our media, information, and our economy as well. And the income inequality is just a part of it. And the same thing has happened with Bernie Sanders. And they've used, in fact, it's been exactly the same. It's been a replica of the way they took on Occupy, except that Bernie Sanders was working on another level from Occupy. He had a better soapbox, and he's an old political, you know, creature. He's been around for a while, and so he was able to get the message across much more strongly than Occupy did, I think, through the media. Even though we know he was silenced and his message was distorted, et cetera, et cetera. And again, one thing that they do is they tend to bracket the message and go for other things. They focus on other things. I heard him once asked if he considered himself sexist to stay in the race. You know, these kinds of questions, which have nothing to do with the issues, and he's very good at dealing with that. So what I'm trying to say is we start to learn the techniques, and I think that Noam Chomsky is really someone you can go back to is almost the first person who really did this kind of deconstruction of the mainstream media. And it's the same, you know, you see this stuff, and you can find it empirically on your own if you know what to look for. And I wanted to go back and say that when I was following the New York Times religiously, you know, for decades, in the 90s, for example, I didn't understand the anti-globalization movement. What the heck are these people protesting? I mean, what's, you know, globalization? What are they, you know, it makes no sense. And then years later, when I was now, you know, also including, still reading the New York Times, but also alternative media, and I was involved in Occupy. And suddenly, I saw people misreporting my movement and my message. our movement and our message. So what I'm trying to say is, you know, I've been on both sides. I've read the skewed media and believed it, and then I've seen the skewed media being its object and seeing how wrong they are. Same thing with the spoiler. You mentioned the spoiler issue. You know, this was used against Ralph Nader, and the New York Times was actually quite vicious. They really tried to make it seem like there was something wrong with him as a person. I can remember this from the time, and I believed it because I had nothing to compare this with. So I believed, and it was years later that I reevaluated Nader, okay? And now they've really retaken the same strategies with Bernie Sanders. So they do have these sort of stock tricks that they use. Yeah.
You know, I just want to interject something there because, you know, you bring up the Nader issue. And, you know, I have a very lively conversation that goes on in my Facebook page where people get together and digest different things that are coming up because, you know, that are happening in our time. Because I think, you know, to hold, because of these, you know, two alternate views of reality. Actually, there are many more views of reality. But the deep divided split that we're discussing that's been created by the media, you know, for people who are on the alternate side that are constantly being invalidated, that are having to spend a lot of energy, which is doing a journalist job, which has long been my job, which is refuting industry or corrupted talking points of various kinds, you know, need a place to get together with each other and sort of share and digest and process some of this stuff and figure out, you know, what do we do now kind of thing. So that's going on a lot on my Facebook page. And one of the things that happens periodically is that somebody will come, you know, because the page is public, or I have a very large group of friends, not all of whom, you know, many of whom I've had for a while, and therefore they don't share. They're not on the same side of the curtain with these current situations. People will come sallying forth. Sometimes they're people I know. Sometimes they're people I know less well, but somehow I've friended along the way. And they'll come in with these mainstream talking points. And they will come on to a discussion of some kind or other. They'll deliver their message, like the message might be, but if we don't vote for Hillary, we'll get Trump. Or Nader was a spoiler is a very common one. And so, and what I found is that when someone comes in with one of these messages, I always make the attempt, because, you know, being a reporter in this world is essentially an educational process, you know, so you don't just blast people with the information, you, you know, engage a dialogue with them about it. And I'll always make the attempt to sort of go, come at the conversation and try to actually have a dialogue. And it's, you know, around these issues, and I've actually gotten to the point where I have made it a rule of my page that if someone comes in and starts talking about Nader as a spoiler, they are being, they're asked to contain their concern about that and participate in the dialogue in another way, and there's information that others will provide them why that isn't true. But when people, and basically what happens is that these mainstream media frames, these memes, function as a form of indoctrination, and people become, absorb them, internalize them, and they become so obsessed with them that they can't look at anything else. And so that has seriously alarmed me, because I, and it's not the case with every person. There are some people who can, but it, you know, or really disagree from their own experience and perspective, and we have those kinds of dialogues. But so often, it's almost like it's rigidified thinking, or obsessional or something, and there's no way for the other information to ever get through. And I find that terrifying.
You know, yes.
Go, you know,
no,
as an anthropologist,
I'm completely agreeing.
What, you know, what are we seeing when this is happening to people? What is happening to our society that this is happening to people?
Okay, that's a fantastic question, and everything you're saying is true. And let me try to sort of walk through this a little bit, and let's tease out a few aspects, things that I've noticed about this phenomenon. Number one, I see three main media bubbles, if you will, or three media universes that where people are getting their information from different places. You know, Trump supporters I'm assuming very few people listening are Trump supporters, they're getting very different information from us. And so they're basing, you know, they're basing their opinions on that information, and we're basing it on something else. So this is where you start to get this fragmentation. And I think the country has fragmented. It does have something to do with media. I think back in the days of, you know, suddenly the Kennedy assassination came into my mind. Maybe that was a turning point where things started to fracture more. I don't know. But, you know, there was a time when there was a shared narrative. There was a large shared American narrative, and that has fractured. So, So what are these three narratives, these three discursive spheres or media spheres that, you know, seem to be dominating right now? One is the traditional, you know, liberal MSNBC and the New York Times and all of that, the liberal stuff that I certainly grew up with, I'm betting you may have as well. Then you've got the sort of right wing. Back in our day, it was, you know, the Daily News, and, you know, and now it's, you know, of course, it's been Fox for many years and other things, you know, and Rush Limbaugh and all of that. So that's another universe of discourse and information. And that has defined the debate now for decades, really since the, you know, for 30 or 40 years, the debate has been polarized around this these two discourses. And all right, I'm gonna dig into it a little deeper. These discourses, which were associated, have been associated until now with the Republican Party on the right and the Democratic Party on the left. These discourses tend to constellate around highly emotive social issues of identity and things like this. So, for example, abortion, guns. Gay marriage. I could, you know, keep pulling them out, but, you know, these very emotional kinds of issues. And the fact is that something like abortion, if you want to be objective about it, you can really understand how somebody could be on both sides of that. You may have your side, and I have my side, and, you know, I'm pro-choice, and that's what I am, but I understand the other side. It's possible to, but these are, whichever side you're on in an issue like that, it's coming from often a very emotional place. Okay, so I think what I'm trying to say is that, you know, and Trump has really, really tapped into that in an amazing way. He's a real media master, and he has tapped into, you know, fear of immigrants, fear of Muslims, and all the terrorism, all this, in a very powerful way. And so this is one of the ways that, you know, but you can also tap into fear of Trump, which is what now is happening, you know, and the Democrats are doing. Fear of Trump. Trump is going, he'll be Hitler. He's going to, you know, the fact is it's completely overblown, even if he wanted to be. And I have my opinions about Trump. I don't think he's Hitler. But even if he wanted to do terrible things, you know, a president only has so much power. There are a lot of limitations on a president's power of action. Presidents don't change things that much. And we can get into that. That's another issue. I know the objections are going to start. What about this? What about that? We can talk about it. A president, the power of the presidency is overrated. What I'm trying to say is, the fear of Trump, the drumming up of the fear of Trump and the fear of racism in this country, which is a very serious thing. I mean, you know, we could go on and we could talk only about racism, structural racism and institutionalized racism in this country and all for this hour, no problem. But what's happening is these issues are being used, are instrumentally by both sides, in different ways to rev people up emotionally. And, you know, this is what concerns me. And I think the point I want, the takeaway from this, I want reader, you know, listeners to think about is that, and I feel very strongly about civil rights and the fight against racism and LGBT, all of those things. But when these issues are used to sugarcoat basically a neo-fascist agenda, mm-hmm. which is actually what's happening, is the two sides fight viciously over prayer in schools or, you know, God knows what. Meanwhile, mm-hmm. they are completely in lockstep when it comes to all sorts of things, like the defense budget, you know, billions and billions of dollars going to Lockheed Martin and all of these. I mean, you know, where is this money going and what's the point? And why do we spend we spend several times our largest competitor. Basically, we spend several times the whole world put together. And, you know, mm-hmm. the numbers are out there, the graphs, we could pull it up. But the point is, you know, why is that not on the table? And so we could mm-hmm. go on and find things. TPP and these trade deals are not mm-hmm. up for discussion. You know, mm-hmm. Nobody was really fighting NSA spying, mass surveillance, for example. Ron Paul, and they tried to make him look like a nut job. Mm-hmm. You know, we could go on and on with, but there is a whole, there's a bedrock of commonality between the two parties that all has to do with power. The restriction of our rights as citizens and the empowerment of corporate actors and the extremely wealthy. And that mm-hmm. is what is shared between the two parties. And so I more and more have come to see this emotionally charged debate about guns and the death penalty and all of these important things. The death penalty is terrible. I'm against it. But when that becomes the focus, while they're putting all these things past us, like, remember Glass-Steagall? I don't remember when I learned about that years later. You know, but they repealed Glass-Steagall,
right.
And then there was the Federal Communications Act. This was all under the first Clinton, right, which created the modern media monopolies. And I wasn't aware of that at the time either. I certainly don't remember it. And then there was, of course, the crime bill, which created the prison. What do they call it now? The Gulag Archipelago. The archipelago.
Yeah, the for-profit prison system.
The prison industrial complex. Sorry, that's it. The prison industrial complex. Anyway, mm-hmm. these pieces of legislation that were put mm-hmm. in place under a supposedly liberal left-wing president who is hated by the right, but these were, you know, the foundation of the sort of the corporate excess that we see today. So,
you know, and we're missing that because we're getting distracted by these emotional issues.
Exactly.
Here's a recent example, and before I give the example, I just want to say mm-hmm. That, you know, when you're actually producing content for the news cycle, which is what a reporter does, and that's what I've done, you notice when things happen concurrently because you're spending years and years and years looking at the news cycle. And for example, I remember a very important AP research study that they spent 2 years on, because this isn't the kind of thing that I cover that affects health and all of that and the environment. And they came out with a study, and it basically revealed that nationwide water supplies were filled with pharmaceutical medicines that people had flushed down the toilet to get rid of them. They hadn't used them. And actually, in many water supplies, people are drinking a combination of a whole bunch of different, you know, dilution, obviously, but, you know, with the elements of a whole bunch of different medications that we weren't supposed to take, we weren't prescribed to take, and we certainly weren't supposed to be taking together all at once. And this is going on. This is, you know, very little has been said about that ever since. Mm-hmm. And I noted that the very day, and of course, there's a very powerful pharmaceutical industry in our country and globally.
Exactly.
On the day that that report was released, there was a sex scandal. And it was the kind of sex scandal that, it was like a prominent public official who had crossed state lines to be with prostitutes, et cetera, et cetera. Very emotional, very fascinating. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. everyone is like gossiping about that immediately, right? Grabs your attention.
Clickbait.
But it was the kind of, right, it's the kind of thing that if they were going to follow this gentleman and find out what he did within his private life, they could have revealed that information at any time at all, right?
Exactly.
And they may have been following him. In fact, you know, they were following him because he was the governor of New York at a time when fracking was going to be becoming an issue in our state, and this was a very aggressive guy who was taken out of the line of action. So, you know, there may have been a perfect rationale, but the timing of it was such that it, you know, accomplished both things simultaneously. And anyone who's worked in PR and marketing knows that timing is key. You know,
exactly.
These things don't happen by accident. So, you know, and it's going to be controversial for me to say this, but at the very moment when issues about election fraud and voter suppression were surfacing, following the, you know, the disenfranchisement of 2.5 million voters in California, the very day that all of that was coming out in articles, in blogs, in films and videos, all, you know, all that very day was the day that Orlando happened. Now,
this
is going to sound like some kind of paranoid conspiracy theory. I don't know. This could have been a soul actor doing anything. But likely it was. But I'm just mentioning that to say that, you know, I notice those things, and we have to notice those things.
Absolutely.
Otherwise, we become like we're chasing after the latest one, and it's like one thing happening over here and another thing happening over there, and that is the entire method, as you point out, of the divide and conquer. And these things are always very emotional. If it's your issue, you absolutely are, you know, they have you by the throat. They have you by the gut. You can't, you're overwhelmed by that. And then everyone else in solidarity is supporting whatever it is. And yet we are missing the same, what's the big picture of what's going on. You know,
absolutely. So, no, I wanted to, I didn't mean to cut you off, but because what you're talking about is really bait and switch. And one of the things that we see on the left is that when it bait and switch, when I hear that term now, I always think of the Bush people, you know, because this was a classic move associated with them. And they were very good at making sure that things came out when it was too late to matter. So we found out, we eventually found out that, yes, what we all knew was true. Bush really did win all the vote, the popular and electoral vote. He did. But we found out late enough so that it didn't matter anymore, and we found out there's just something now that's come out in Britain. You may have seen that, you know, there more findings about the Iraq war and how it was all cooked up, but now it doesn't matter anymore. And there, the Bush people were masters, and that was Rove, I really think, was a master at that kind of thing. And what you're talking about is the sort of bait and switch. So, for example, if there's a story you don't like, you need to find something else. And you have contacts in the media, which we know about Rove and his talking points. Now, what happened this year, Alice, that I found absolutely fascinating was that all of those awful things that we already knew and associated with Rove, with the Bush-Cheney people, suddenly, for the first time, we were seeing it from the Democrats. And that was a real shock for a person like me. You know, it's the first time you could really see the dirty tricks. And, you know, we could argue about different ones, but the whole panorama of it is breathtaking. A lot of stuff happened. I don't know if you agree. California.
Tell us about some of the things that you noticed in that regard that you would call Rovian.
Well, I mean, we could go on. Geez, I mean, we could go on and on with the details about this primary. It was shady from day one. I mean, well, you know, starting the whole thing with the Hillary Victory Fund and the way they made these deals with the 32 or 33 state DNCs before the race started, they already had deals where that involved, you know, basically you support us and we'll pool our funds and we'll bring on all the Hillary big donors and it's going to help you. And, I mean, real backroom wheeling and dealing, the very shady stuff for what's supposed to be a democratic process. And so it started with things like that. The involvement of the media was horrific. I mean, you know, Chris Matthews' wife has some involved, you know more about this than me, but in other words, there were people who had very clear conflicts of interest you know, some clearer than others. But Chris Matthews was an example. That was somebody who shouldn't have been reporting on it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so there was just, and it just went on and on and on. I mean, right up until this week with the plane stopping, and then the FBI saying, oh yeah, she lied, and you know, she did, and she basically revealed classified information, which is what we've jailed Manning and others for. But it's, you know, it's not worth pursuing. You know, I mean, it's just been a panorama.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm. It's not worth pursuing. Yeah, that is, really, really mystifying. And, you know, I think that actually is a galvanizing. It's an interesting thing, just as a kind of an aside. But, there's tremendous outrage among progressives about this because of the perception. You know, the progressives, the Sanders supporters, are the ones who are looking deeply into Hillary Clinton's record versus her current kind of superficial talking points throughout the election, and contrasting the two to really, mm-hmm. See how she will lead if elected. Whereas I know that a lot of the Clinton people are saying, we'll persuade her, we'll move her left, we'll do this, we'll do mm-hmm. that. What they base this on is not is basically, again, what you're saying with identity politics. It's an emotional mm-hmm. resonance with a candidate as another woman. But there's a complete disconnect between, yes, she's a woman like me, oh, it's so nice to see someone in that position, and mm-hmm. this is her record, this is what she's done, these are what her war efforts look like, these are what her environmental, her poor role in the environment has been. Did the fact that she got up and for 2 seconds in a debate, you know, make some pleasing statements? I mean, how conclusive is that when we have already seen mm-hmm. with president after president after president that the campaign promises and the idealism and enthusiasm, you know, completely changes once they're in office? And if someone already has, which President Obama did not have, but Clinton does, a pre-existing long-standing record, you know, we don't do the hard cognitive work of looking at the record and projecting forward from that.
Exactly.
Instead, we are, you know, lured into responding emotionally and then having idealistic hopes. So with this whole thing with the emails, we have the progressives who've been drilling deep into the issues and are very concerned about the, many examples of half-truths and dishonesty and changing your mind and covering for what you did in the past. And then mm-hmm. on the other side, you have the right-wing people, and actually both are from different angles, looking and seeing the same thing. And it's
Allison,
an interesting thing there. Mm-hmm.
Allison, that is really, and that is one of the most infuriating. I can say that I cannot believe, dealing with Hillary people, has been really agonizing. And a lot of people I know, women as well as men, have had this problem of dealing with, Hillary people, because it's very agonistic. It's very hard to explain it. There's something going on there that goes beyond just, the record. And, you just said something that I really wanted to jump in. Ah, yes. One of the things, of course, that they say is, because she's a woman, so I've been accused of sexism. When I'm accused of sexism, I point out that I'm voting for Jill Stein.
Mm-hmm.
And are we supposed to vote for Sarah Palin because she was a woman? Should we have voted for her? Is it sexist not to vote for Sarah Palin? Don't I have a right to vote for Jill Stein? Isn't she a woman too? Or don't I have a right not to like a female candidate because I don't like their policies? Even if they're a woman, and et cetera. But that's one aspect. But again, that's the identity politics. Then you have the emotional issues politics too coming in. And then you have the fear politics, fear of Trump. Then you have the personality politics. So there's a narrative that people have, and that goes in, it's personality of the candidate and personality of their followers. So you have the story about the Bernie Bros. You have the story about, how all Sanders followers are basically white males, which is not true at all. In the younger demographic, there's tremendous women overwhelmingly support Sanders when you get below a certain age, 30, say, you know, et cetera. So, there's a generational thing there, not so much about gender. But what I'm trying to say is, they look for anything but the issues, you know, anything but the issues. So it's, oh yes, the Clintons have been smeared by the right. Oh yes. And, and so then we have the thing that you mentioned, which is the left and the right are saying very similar things. When the FBI thing, Comey came out, you know, people on the left and the right were rolling their eyes in the same way and thinking and saying pretty much the same thing. So now the narrative is that people like me, I guess, you have been brainwashed by the right. Because we think that we saw Clinton on fracking, the way she prevaricated on the Goldman transcripts, you know, you could go on and on and on. These are things we saw with our own eyes. And we're told that, no, we've been influenced by the right. Mm-hmm. And I mean, it's insulting, but it's also a deflection, because it puts the question onto our psychology as opposed to the real issues. And finally, what's really interesting and powerful about the fact that people on the left and the right, which are in very different media universes, as we said at the beginning, you know, I don't watch Fox News. How could I be influenced by the right? You know, so, and they're not influenced by me. But why are we seeing the same thing? Well, maybe because it's that obvious that everybody sees it, regardless of their political stripe, you know? Mm-hmm. And so this, you know, these dismissals are, as you said, they're like talking points. They're you could make lists of them. What will the Hillary people say? You know, basically this is coming from the media. It's coming from people like Matthews or, some of those other people on MSNBC, et cetera.
They have contributed, I would say, retrospectively to this polarization at the MSNBCs. I mean, I watched them myself for a time, and in the same way that you're discussing, you know, it's visceral and emotional to kind of have this enemy, and the Republicans, you know, with their utter cluelessness and cynicism and the fact that, you know, the people that buy them are really into stripping down our entire social contract, really. They certainly, you know, there's a lot of problems there, and I'm not for them at all. But construing the entire thing as a kind of a horse race, which happens even outside of election years, is not helpful to us. And, you know, one of the things, because I've been covering the TPP since 2014, that we've seen is that there's opposition to the trade agreements, so-called. Actually, it's, you know, a corporate takeover. You know, on both the true left and the right, and it's the centrists, both Democratic and Republican, the Wall Street group, that is really pushing forth this agenda. And, you know, so actually there is this interesting, possibility of a coalition, of some kind, except that the individuals that are, you know, kind of representing those groups are themselves, quite difficult, but the actual groups of people with their complaints, with their problems, with what they like and they don't like, may not be as far away from each other, apart from on these very important domestic issues that you're mentioning, where there is, you know, there is significant disagreement in view. But on these more overarching things, actually a lot in common. Yeah.
Yes, 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 and this is really where I think we can really go to kind of bring all this to there's a conclusion in this. This is where things are going. This is what's happening. This is the situation that's emerging now. Is we've had this discourse that we've discussed, the two sides represented by Fox and NBC, MSNBC, in kind of cartoony terms, or the Republicans and the Democrats. We've had this, and talking about these emotional issues and the identity politics, et cetera. That's what we've been dealing with. And meanwhile, under the surface, there has been this corporate takeover churning along, you know, basically without anybody noticing it. But when they do notice it, it upsets people on all ends of the spectrum. The only people it doesn't upset are what I am starting to call the corporate center. Basically, what has happened is you've created these two narratives in the two parties, and so you have coalitions on both sides. The right has different things going on. There are fiscal conservatives, there are social conservatives, there's the religious right, there are straight up racist, nativist, you know, anti-immigrant, all of that kind of thing. You know, there are all these different groups, libertarians, you know, who kind of pool together under the Republicans, and that really have different agendas. And then on the left, you have, you know, people who are more sort of democratic socialist types or social democrats. You have social justice people, et cetera, et cetera. And these coalitions have increasingly been led by corporate centers. That the DNC and RNC today, the people, you know, remember when Trump was winning, they trotted out Romney. The guy they thought, their Hillary was going to be Jeb Bush. That didn't work. And then when Jeb failed, they trotted out Romney to kind of mutter something about, you know, please do what we tell you. And it didn't work. And so, you know, the Republicans actually succeeded in their coup within their own party. The Republican base, the Democrats failed. So far. But both parties are experiencing this kind of this pressure from, which comes from the fact that the party elites, the party establishments do not represent any of the groups in their coalition. What they represent is the corporate agenda. And they're actually much more like one another. Even right down to things, well, Hillary supported the war in Iraq, you know, right down to things like that. Look at all the things Obama's done. Healthcare, great idea, except it's turned into a bonanza for the insurance industry and the pharmaceuticals. The surveillance and all kinds of very draconian, very, you know, neo-fascist kinds of things that happened under Obama, too. So the fact is that these both sides are driving an agenda that is neither the right-based agenda or the left-based agenda. So what's happened is we have this corporate center. It's not really a center. It's just where the power is. And it's backed by the media, you know, because MSNBC, again, is. I think this was in the piece I wrote. Was that the one where I talked a bit about GE and Comcast, and you know, we have to understand.
About that. I think that's really important.
We'll get to that in a second. But you know, we have to understand who are these people who are giving us our news. I mean, GE is the 18th largest defense contractor in the world. You know, do we trust them to report on military matters? You know. Comcast is one of the largest lobbyists in American politics. It's a corporation that puts hundreds of millions of dollars into lobbying. So if these people are NGA too, of course, lobbies, and if these people are plying our government with money and pushing specific policies, tax policies, deregulation, and whatever they're trying to do, you know, do we really think that they're going to give us objective news when they're investing all of this money to influence policy? And here they are. They control media. You know, they're not going to use that to their own benefit. So anyway, I don't want to get too deep into that, but the media is a part of the whole thing. It's a very important part of the power structure.
One thing that you said. You know, the takeaway for me in what you just said is that, you know, there's this, for example, there's been a lot of complaint that actually MSNBC, CNN, and other outlets helped create the Trump candidacy by, you know, giving him such a broad media platform. And then if you bring that up to people, the majority of people will quote a statement made by Les Moonves of CBS where he said, you know, it's terrible for the country, but it's he's good for CBS, you know. And so this, you know, the idea, so of course this gives the idea, we're only doing it for the ratings. We're a bunch of, you know, corrupt people who are out for money alone, and we're only doing this for the ratings. So every time you bring up this problem of their having created Trump and why did they do it, you know, what you'll hear is, oh, for the ratings, mm-hmm. they're cynical, we're cynical, right. Hey, that's the way it works. Actually, it never occurs to anyone that it could be for the reasons you're talking about, and when
exactly.
And in fact it is, and when Les Moonves made that statement, he was making it as a misdirection. Instead, everybody,
exactly.
it was widely quoted, and everybody takes it as the gospel's truth. He's like confessing
absolutely.
To us. He's making himself seem like a bad guy. Oh, now we know what's happening, you know?
Absolutely.
It's like, wink, wink.
This is so important. It's such a wide misconception. And what you're saying is, what's really sinister here is that the media itself is perpetuating this. Oh, it's all about the ratings. Trump gets good ratings, so that's why they're giving him all the airtime. Bernie doesn't get good. All right, Bernie's filling stadiums with 20,000 people. He's breaking fundraising records. You know, massive volunteers, et cetera. You know, but this isn't a good story. This is, nobody wants to see this. You know, it's all about the ratings. So the problem with that, the thing that's really nefarious, sinister about it, is that it sounds cynical. So you're like, yeah, I get it. It's all about the ratings. Of course, you know, and because it seems like a cynical thing, you feel like you've got to kind of one-up because you believe
right.
this. But the fact is that, as I said, if these same companies are pouring hundreds of millions of dollars into influencing policy, you know, and writing laws, they're literally writing some of these bills, et cetera. You know, they, you know, when you look, I'm trying to think of an example in dollar terms, but basically lobbying is an incredible investment because when you change a law, you know, say a tax law, GE actually gets a rebate from or has gotten rebates from the U.S. government. At tax time, they get rebates. They're not paying taxes. They're getting money from the system. So, you know, that's from decades of working the law, of changing laws. And so this is an incredible, why bother with ratings when you can make money in other ways and increase your power and influence in other ways? It's not just about money. You know, it ultimately becomes about power. And that's what people need to understand. So I think the point, the big takeaway as we're coming into the home stretch, one big takeaway about the media is that these are political actors. They are political actors. They're involved. They're big players in the political system, these corporations that own our media and others that are connected to them. And you know, so to think that the media is somehow that they have that, you know, that Orwell and Goebbels, all these people talked about, you know, the power of media, you know, but they don't use that because all they're interested in is the ratings, not influencing what people think. Come on, you know.
Yeah. Well, that really explodes that one pretty thoroughly. Thank you. That really... Yeah, that's really brilliant. That makes so much sense. You know, we have only a few more minutes here, but let's take those just to talk a little bit, to access a little bit of your perspective as an anthropologist, because one of the reasons we don't know what you're saying is because we bought it. You know, we swallowed. We've been barraged by these messages, and we've swallowed them and come to believe them, and they've defined our reality. But,
exactly.
you know, part of it also, you know, so what happens? I mean, I think we know something in our, you know, self-oriented society about personal psychology and how I feel and what makes me feel comfortable. But what do we need to know about group and social psychology and the rules about how societies self-organize and how... the participants, therefore, believe, experience themselves, and act.
Okay.
Big topic for the last 3 minutes, but
Yeah. Okay. And I want to say something very quickly again about the discourses and where I think things are going politically. So I'll go real fast with this one because we've got a lot of untied ends here. But just quickly on that, you know, when I talk to people who I'm fascinated by people who only, you know, who watch MSNBC, who only read the New York Times, et cetera, who aren't exposed to Democracy Now! Or the Young Turks or Truth Dig or a lot of the things you mentioned at the beginning. And they say things, I remember, you know what, they'll say things like, I remember talking years ago with somebody about Assange, and the person said, yeah, he's kind of, and I said, yeah, he's revealed all these incredible things, and they said, yeah, but he's kind of sketchy, though. You know, this kind of thing, like, sketchy, like, that's, in other words, people are, you know, like, you know, Nader was an egotist, you know, in other words, you know, and they did what they did to Gore, actually. He was starting to look like a sore loser and he couldn't let go. And in other words, and so how do you create these perceptions or these impressions? You know, another one is, and we're not getting into this, but, you know, 9/11 and just to give one example, it's like, or conspiracy theories in general, like any, you know, people can just use the word conspiracy theory and it's supposed to, and it shuts you up. Like you can't, you know, it's a conversation stopper if you call something a conspiracy. But the fact is that conspiracies do exist. Like they have existed and it makes sense. I mean, that doesn't mean that there are two sides to this. It doesn't mean that everything is a conspiracy, but to throw things, to deny things out of hand is conspiracy. Anyway, but what happens is,
we've only got about another minute or two left here, just letting you know.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, anyway, I mean, that's the social psychology, that we create these perceptions. But just very quickly, I wanted to end, if I can end very fast, and say that this is what we have. We have a corporate center, and we have a rebellion happening on the left and on the right. We saw it with Brexit in England, and with Jeremy Corbyn, we've seen that too, the bit of the rebellion, but Brexit now on the right. That what people are reacting to is this neoliberal, neoconservative center, this neocorporate, I'm starting to call the neos, this corporate center that pretends to be the center, but it's not. It's not the center of anything but power. So I want to, we can walk away and think about that. That I think what's happening is the waters are getting confused and muddied because there are two rebellions going on, one on the left and one on the right, but they're rebelling against the same thing. So, we have these.
So actually, that contains some potential for a different way of thinking and a different way of organizing around these issues is what I'm hearing and what you say, and that's hopeful. We're going to have you back on the show, Peter Cullen. Really, this has been a fantastic conversation. Everybody, check out this current article, Peter Cullen, Elephant Journal. Google it, read up, get involved. And thank you so much. This has been an exceptional conversation. We will continue the conversation because I want to hear the second part of it, too. But you've left us with something terrific. There's some opportunities that we weren't aware of. Thank you, Peter.
My pleasure. Nice talking to you, Allison.
And thank you, listeners, for being with us on Connect the Dots. Come back next Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm Allison Rose Levy. Be well. Stop.